Insane Freeze, which is now the country's largest peace organization with a membership of over 180,000 people. This group is based in Washington, D.C., and was formed a couple of years ago when two other groups merged. That was the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy and the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. Well, let me tell you a little bit more about our guest this morning. He was born in New York City. He studied at Yale. When he started out there, he was studying music. His studies were interrupted by the Second World War. He served for a time in the U.S. Army as a liaison officer to the French and the Russian armies. He returned to Yale in 1947 and graduated with a degree in government. He worked from 1950 until 53 for the CIA. He returned to the United States in 1953 and entered Yale Divinity School. He graduated from there. In 1957, he was named chaplain of Yale University and held that post for 18 years. During those years, he also served as an advisor to the Peace Corps and as a co-founder of Clergy and Laity Concerned for Vietnam. He has, for the past 25 years, been a strong presence in the civil rights and peace movements, and he became senior minister of Riverside Church in New York City in 1977 and founded its disarmament program shortly thereafter. Last July, he announced that he'd be stepping down from that post and gave his last sermon there in December, and with the new year became president of Sane Freeze and is now on a national speaking tour. We're very pleased to have him with us this morning. And as we talk, you folks who are listening are also invited to talk with us, to call in if you have comments or questions. Our telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere in the state of Illinois, and that is 800-222-9455. I appreciate your being here very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
And especially since you're struggling with a cold, like probably about half the population of the country. So
I apologize to you hearers out there for the unmusical sound.
At this point, now that we have concluded the INF agreement with the Soviet Union and hope that that will be ratified, and we have both sides talking about the possibility of a significant limitation in longer-range weapons. At this point, now that we have news that is encouraging on the arms limitation front, where do you see the freeze movement going, and what sort of role do you think it has to play in continuing to move things along?
Well, first of all, we haven't got those 67 senators automatically there for ratification, but I hope they will be there, and I hope everybody will do everything they can to see the ratification takes place, and then rejoice in the fact that a right-wing president concluded a treaty with the Soviet Union, which for the first time in 40 years lowered or retired a class of nuclear weapons. And this right-wing president is now looking to the democratically controlled Congress, Senate, for ratification. It shows that we might possibly have a new bipartisan foreign policy which reflects a lot of wisdom, I'd say, foreign policy fit for children. Mm-hmm. Now, what the peace movement has to do is to make sure the first step doesn't become a sidestep and that it leads quickly to the second step, which, as you just mentioned, is far more significant, namely a 50% reduction in the big strategic nuclear weapons. Gorbachev wants it. President Reagan says he wants it. I don't think he's going to get it without sacrificing SDI, because the Soviets see SDI very differently than the average American. But if they had been the first to come up with it, we would see it exactly the way they do. They say to us, you are undermining deterrence by a refusal to be deterred. They say to us, come on, you Americans, we know that you're developing first strike capabilities. That's the whole point of the nuclear arms race in the 1980s. And they may be well doing the same, parenthetically. But we know that your Pentagon estimates that by 1995, between the Trident submarine with its D-5 missiles and the land-based MX missiles, you can eliminate 98% of our silos and our bombers on the ground. Now, if that's the case, you can't blame us for thinking of your nuclear shield as a means to protect yourselves against the retaliatory strike after you have hit us with your first strike. So I don't think you can ask the Soviets to shorten their nuclear sword as you lengthen your nuclear shield. There's a fundamental incompatibility between a 50% reduction and SDI.
What do you think the mood in the Congress at the moment about SDI and the future of SDI is?
Well, I don't think most Congress people are all that happy about it. But none of the Republican candidates are ready to scrap it. I'm glad to note that all the Democratic candidates say this genie has to be stuffed back into the bottle. The irony is, you know, that in the last decade, when the Premier Kosygin of the Soviet Union wanted to put up an anti-ballistic missile system around Moscow and said, this is only defense. Lyndon Johnson and his administration came down on him hard, said, what do you mean this is only defense? You're trying to protect yourselves against any retaliatory strike on our part. It was the same argument, only we took the Russian side then. And that produced the anti-ballistic missile treaty of 1972, which limited what you could do, quote, defensively, very sharply. So it's an interesting kind of ironic history here. Yeah.
Do you feel that the peace movement in this country was in some part responsible for making it possible to get the INF agreement and to go beyond that?
I think, first of all, let me say that I don't want to take any credit away from President Reagan. If he wants to claim credit for it, that's fine. You know, let's not get into a futile argument as to who deserves the credit and who the blame. I think the fact that he's finally embraced it is a little like Nixon finally going to China. You know, Nixon said we were traitors to suggest we ought to recognize China in the 1950s, but then he went. Reagan said, this is an evil empire. I will not conclude any arms agreement with him, and then he did. But to get to your point, I think the European peace movements also played a very important role. The British peace movement came up with the INF proposal, basically, in 1980. And representatives of the Fries in England, in Europe, talked to a German general who said, this is a splendid idea, we'll talk to Schmidt. And you remember, Schmidt was the one who said to Reagan, if you bring in these Pershing 2s, if you bring in these cruise missiles into Western Europe, and specifically into Germany, you're also going to have to start talking about arms reduction in Geneva. You've got to have this two-track system. Otherwise, politically, it's impossible for me. So it was the pressures of the American and the European peace movements together which I think helped the process along considerably.
Mm-hmm. I think I neglected at the beginning of the program to give our telephone numbers. Let me do that and say once again, our guest this morning is the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. He is the newly elected president of Sane Fries, a national group that's opposed to the proliferation of nuclear weapons. It's based in Washington, D.C. He is currently on a nationwide speaking tour. And if you'd like to be a part of our program, maybe you have questions or comments of your own to offer, the telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to call in, do give us a call. Do you think that that a world without nuclear weapons is possible?
Oh, yeah. I think that people are going to recognize more and more that in the nuclear age, the more weapons you have, the less security they buy. I think people are going to recognize that Einstein was correct in saying the release of the power of the atom has changed everything except our way of thinking. I think our way of thinking is going to push us now. It's going to change. We do the right and wise thing, but only after exhausting all alternatives, as Abby Eden once said. I think that there will be a lot of pressure to reduce nuclear weapons, and once the superpowers begin to reduce their nuclear arsenals, then they'll be in a position to insist that other nations, Libya, Iraq, excuse me, Israel, South Africa, renounce their nuclear weapons or access the nuclear weapons, and insist on strict international inspection so that we'll have a stringent international inspection system against nuclear weapons all over the world. And if one country doesn't want to sign on, that country, I think, ought to anticipate strict international sanctions because this is serious business, and this is something we have to all do together. So I don't think it's that much of a problem. I think the tougher problem is going to be to reduce significantly conventional weapons, which I would like very much to see done on both sides. And if we can get the conventional weapons down, then we can spare the world a lot of grief and save the nations of the world an awful lot of money. Money which is desperately needed to revitalize the economies of an awful lot of countries, and particularly, I would say, the bottom 30% of the economic ladder.
Do you think that there is anything to that line of reasoning that says that the reason that we have not had a significant war since World War II is the presence of nuclear weapons, that says that the kind of destruction that they would bring about is so terrible that that has prevented people from going to war, and that if we remove those weapons, that it will seem much, the idea of having a war would seem much more acceptable, and that would make it much more likely?
Well, the trouble with that argument, there's several difficulties I have with it. First of all, if you have a war with conventional weapons and one side begins to lose, it is altogether natural to expect them to crank up the nuclear weapons again. I think one of the most frightening characteristics of the world is that the knowledge, the know-how, how to make nuclear weapons is part of the storehouse of human knowledge now forever and ever and ever. And that's why you can't talk glibly about conventional warfare if people have the capacity to crank up nuclear weapons. The other thing I'd say is, I was 3 years, as you mentioned, in the CIA. I was in the Russian field. And it never occurred to to the Atlantic. It made no sense whatsoever. And it was never in their ideological cards that communism would spread through military means. That's not the essence of communism at all. So I've never been that impressed by that argument.
We do have two callers, so we have one caller here. I'm told they're calling long distance, so we'll go right to them. Other folks are invited into the program, 333-9455, toll free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. We have our first caller right here. Hello.
Hi, Reverend Coffin. I'm studying the 1960s with its anti-war protests,
mm-hmm.
and I know that you figured in those protests. As a matter of fact, you were accused of advising people how to avoid the draft at one time, weren't you?
No, I was indicted and convicted of aiding and abetting draft resistance, not how to avoid the draft, but how to resist the draft, which is quite a difference.
Okay. Well, I found a quote from you in an old Time magazine about the God is Dead movement. It says here, Yale's Protestant chaplain William Sloan Coffin reports that a girl said to me the other day, I don't know whether I'll ever believe in God, but Jesus is my kind of guy. Do you remember that quote?
Yeah, I do.
Well, anyway, I'm...
I remember the woman, too. She was pretty neat.
Could you tell me in your own words, what did the God is Dead movement mean to you? What was that all about?
Well, I never thought it was very good theology. See, basically what it was saying was, how can you possibly talk about an all-powerful, all-loving God when practically every inch of the earth is soaked with the tears and the blood of the innocent?
Mm.
Now, that's a perfectly good position.
Yes.
But on the other hand, if it is a loving God, love is self-restrictive when it comes to power. Just like a parent will not exert power over a child if that is to destroy the independence, the maturing of the child, right?
Yes.
And if God has given us freedom, then the fact that every inch of the earth is soaked with the tears and blood of the innocents is because of our misuse of the freedom God gave us. If you believe that love is the name of the game, freedom has to be the presupposition. And the fact that 6 million Jews died was not an indictment of God. in my mind, as it was an indictment of us, so that every time people say, oh, Lord, how long, yes. we should say to ourselves, look, that's exactly the question God is putting to every one of us.
Well, now, do you think that the shift, would you acknowledge that there was a kind of a shift away from Christian moral values in the 1960s?
No, I thought it was a good deal of ethical unrest, and that's quite Christian. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who might say we weren't responding to God, but I think, I mean, we don't believe in God, but in my book, they were responding, if you will, to God.
I see.
You see, I think it's a great mistake to keep talking about student unrest in the 60s.
Yes.
That gets everybody else off the hook. If we call it a decade of ethical unrest, then everybody would have to ask themselves, well, why are we less ethical?
Well, do you think that the 1960 unrest was influenced, the moral shift, the value shift that took place there, was a shift toward what we'd call, humanist-inspired values?
Yeah, I mean, the ethics of thick humanists are not that different from the ethics of Jews and Christians. It's only a question of where they see this will to love coming from, right?
Yeah, and I have one more question. The values that we have now are probably more humanist-inspired than, or at least it seems to me that the stern Christian values that we had during the 50s, those have been softened quite a bit, wouldn't you say?
Well, it depends. You see, when you say stern Christian values, we in the 50s were more concerned with free love than free hate.
Yeah, but the student, one of the things the students were rebelling against in the 60s was the stern moral ethics of their parents. They said, make love, not war. You
right.
know, that was one of their big slogans, make
I
love,
think,
not war.
Yeah. I see what you're saying. I think I agree with you that there was a great resistance against the strict moral conduct in interpersonal relationships when it came to drinking, when it came to sex, and when it came to drugs. What I liked about the 60s was that a lot of students said the issues of poverty, the issues of war and peace are altogether as important as interpersonal relationships between middle-class parents and children. And that was to the good. And that's quite biblical, whether they knew it or not. Thank you.
here was the most, it was the richest society in history,
right.
And it was going to abolish poverty,
right.
And we had all these values that came out of the 60s, and we couldn't do it.
Right, we gave up.
Oh.
I agree with you. I think one of the worst things you can say about President Reagan is that he's made us comfortable in our prejudices.
Well,
so racism has come on, indifference to the poor has returned, hunger, which is a problem, was virtually licked. 10 years ago, is now a major problem in American society.
Can we say this about the value shifts of the 60s? Prior to the 60s, we had no problem with venereal disease. We had very little problem with illegitimate births. Now, after the 60s, we have a terrible problem with those things. Have we gone backwards? Were those stern moral values of the 50s and before the 60s? Those seem to have worked better than the values we have now.
Well, it gets a little complicated, it seems to me. People were more repressed, too.
Yeah.
Okay? And people who are repressed tend to be repressive.
Mm-hmm.
Then they get very concerned about personal things, personal piety, personal conduct, and then they forget about these kind of giant issues of the day, like the fact that, you know, almost a third of the world is living in near misery and poverty. And we're all about to blow ourselves to kingdom come unless we pay some attention to these major issues. So it's complicated, I think, you know?
Mm. The pressure that President Reagan has put on military buildup,
mm-hmm.
do you give that pressure any credit at all for some of the advances we've made with the Soviet Union? I mean, Gorbachev did come in, we did sign a treaty.
Well, I think Mr. Gorbachev, for his own internal reasons, wants to revitalize his own economy. He's absolutely horrified by the amount of money that's going down the drain in the arms race. And he saw that long before we did. And finally, when we begin to see that we have two towering debts and that the arms race is dreadful for our economy, too, I think there were a lot of reasons that brought the two together to conclude this treaty.
I want to jump in here just to say to the caller that I have some other people waiting, and I want to go on to them. Was there maybe one last point you wanted to make?
I'm most pleased to have talked to Reverend Sloan Coffin.
I think it's a mixed bag, you know. We get better in one area and worse in another area. I wouldn't want to make comparative judgments between the 50s, let's say, and the 80s.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much. We'll go on to some other callers here. Our guest, by the way, this morning is the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. He has just been elected president of Sane Freeze, which is a national arms limitation group. He was, for 10 years you were at Riverside?
Right.
For the last 10 years, he was the senior minister at Riverside Church in New York City. He just stepped down at the end of last year to take on the presidency of Sane Freeze. Why did you do that? Why did you step down?
I think it's a terrific moment, one of these rare moments in history when, because the show is over in this country, I think we've been to the movies sort of for the last 7 or 8 years, and the show is now over, and American people are blinking on the sidewalk wondering what are we going to do next. I think we're ready for something better, something wiser, something more decent in this country, and I think we're exceedingly lucky to have somebody like Gorbachev over there to deal with. And this is one of those moments that we have to capitalize on because it's not going to come around that often. If Gorbachev fails, I hate to think who's coming after him. After every reformer comes reaction. And so I just felt the full-time peace and justice ministry, if you will, was the kind of ministry I wanted now.
Hmm. Well, let's go on and talk with some other people. Let's go to our toll-free line here. Hello.
Yes, Reverend.
Yes.
The world is spending $1.5 million a minute on wars.
Right.
And the United States has been telling our people that the Russians are coming for the last 40 years. The Russians have been telling their people that the Yankees are coming 40 years. Consequently, both countries are bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
The world is bankrupt. That's why we have all this poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have war with the have-nots. You know, we're just having war mm-hmm. with the elite now in those countries. The day is going to come where the have-nots are going to have war in the streets all over the world.
I'm afraid I agree with you. I think
and it's
that's
our own making, really.
Yep, I agree with you. I think that Japan is now beginning to show this country that geopolitics is out and geoeconomics is in. That economics is where it's at.
They're beating us on Main Street. We beat them in the war.
That's right. But they're now the chief creditor nation, and
right.
You and I are sitting in the chief debtor nation of the world for the very reasons that you just gave.
What happens when they withdraw their funds that they have invested in government bonds over here in Germany also and some of the other foreign countries?
We could be in deep economic trouble.
Yep.
Unfortunately,
like a Sunday picnic.
All right. I think you ought to be sitting in my place.
You know, I've seen this happen. I've predicted this 40 years ago with my wife, and she says, oh, yeah, the collapse is coming, the collapse is coming, the collapse is coming. Well, I told her, you just look around and see how many farmers have bit the dust and how many people lost their properties in the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just hasn't hit home to the average person in the street.
But don't you feel...
It happened to them.
Yeah, don't you feel it's beginning now to hit home? That Reagan is being a bit discredited, that the farm foreclosures are really getting to people, the number of homeless rising in the cities is beginning to get to people. My feeling is the American people are ready now to do something different.
Now, what are we going to do? The damage has already been done.
Well, if we can continue to now on this reduction of the arms, for instance, and with that money revitalize our economies, if we can refuse to intervene militarily in the internal affairs of third world countries, as you were saying, so that we support the haves against the have-nots, then if we can stop intervention, if we can stop the arms race, if we can take the money saved and use it to help the bottom 30% of our economic ladder, we'll be doing already something a lot better, don't you think?
Yeah, but the people don't want to pay the taxes. They're not willing to pay the taxes. If anyone runs for president and says, I'm going to raise taxes, he gets defeated. People don't want to hear the truth.
Well,
they just want to hear the good side of everything. There's also the bad side. The bad side outweighs the good side.
Well, my feeling is that, as I said, I think earlier, that what Abba Eden at Israel said, nations and people do the right and wise thing, but only after exhausting all alternatives.
True.
And I think we've just about exhausted those alternatives. At least that's what I'm banking on.
We're forced to negotiate whether we want to or not, and they are too.
Right.
For our own preservation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Talking with us this morning is Reverend William Sloan Coffin. Recently, he became president of a national peace organization, Sane Freeze is the name of the group. He was previously for 10 years the senior minister of Riverside Church in New York City. Before that, for a number of years, he was chaplain of Yale University, and we're pleased to have him here. We have a couple of callers here on the line, so we want to go on to them. Something else I just want to ask you about briefly, and then we'll go on to callers. Do you really think that it is fair to pin all of the bad things that are going on now on Ronald Reagan? It seems to me,
no.
For example, the beginning of the week, we had the observation of Martin Luther King, the holiday for Martin Luther King. And a lot of people took it as an opportunity to say that that America is becoming more racist and it's Ronald Reagan's fault. Mm-hmm. Is that really fair to you?
No, I think that what I often say is when we got started as a nation in 1780s, we had a population of 3 million, which is less than Los Angeles County today. And yet we turn out a generation of states people named Washington, Adams, Hamilton, Franklin, Jefferson. You could name a list as long as your arm. Now with a population 70, 80 times as great, how many states people can we name the caliber of that first generation of states people? Now the reason for it is, as Plato said, what's honored in a country will be cultivated there. And we have terrific football players like the Redskins and the Broncos, and we deserve them because we honor football and we cultivate football players. And I'm afraid Ronald Reagan doesn't represent us wisely, but represents us all too well. I think in a democracy, we get what we deserve to a much greater degree than that to which we would gladly admit. So I certainly would not blame Ronald Reagan without taking a lot of the blame upon myself as a citizen of this country. Because we voted him in.
Let's go on to another caller. Someone here, line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning, David, and good morning, Reverend.
Good morning.
God bless you both. I do have some questions and concerns about the recent IMF treaty. But first, I do have some disagreements with you. You said that, and made a statement that people back then in the 50s were less concerned about the poor and things like that than they were today.
I don't agree. No, I think that the 50s and the 80s in that respect are pretty much the same. 50s was a pretty bland time.
Well, I don't think it's too bland now. Well, I guess it depends on where you, your position.
Well, I don't think it's so bland now, but I think our indifference to the poor is quite high. I mean, we've allowed millions and millions of fellow Americans to fall below the federally established poverty line, and that troubles me. Doesn't it bother you?
Well, I think there's less concern about the poor in the sense that we want to say, let the government take care of it rather than taking care of it ourselves. When's the last time you or me even actually took a homeless person into our own homes?
Well,
to me, that is much more of a stronger statement than saying Ronald Reagan is evil because he's not spending $200 billion on a, you know, whatever program.
Well, I think I agree with you that charity is very important, taking a person into your home. But I don't think charity is a substitute for justice. Justice is a more equitable distribution of resources. Now, I'm impressed that when I was coming out of college in the 40s, Mr. Conservative of those days was Robert Taft, Senator Taft. And Senator Taft, Mr. Conservative, said that the one thing the private sector cannot provide is low-income housing. And that is a public responsibility. And so he sponsored the Taft Housing Bill, whose goal was a decent home for every American family. Now, 40 years later, what has happened to that vision of Mr. Conservative?
Yeah, well, in a sense, I do agree with him. You know, I think we need some form of public housing. But then again, once we start spending more and more money on all these government programs, it seems like they get more and more corrupt. You know, we start getting people skinning money off the top, or they're, you know, selling food stamps in the streets for a few extra dollars, you know, and then spending it on booze. And it seems to me that if we were more of a charitable nation, you'd have much more control, there'd be less graft. And, of course, the poor would have more dignity. They would be, you know, you'd be able to help them out on an individual basis rather than having a cold, impersonal government just handing out money.
Listen, if a cold and impersonal government can build you a warm and cozy house, that's not a bad thing. And the graft and the corruption that you talk about is in high places. And what I've been living on Manhattan, and I can tell you the greed of the rich so makes the greed of the poor look like nothing. I mean, the expenditures of the rich on things that are strictly luxurious, when the poor are without things that are strictly necessary, is to me a terrible reflection on the nation. And that we need to be much more concerned with the bottom 30% of the economic ladder. Now, I'm not saying that the government's the only one, the federal government's the only one that can build low-income housing. I'm saying we've got to have low-income housing as a high priority. We need fewer homeless and more homes. Now, if we can put together some combination of private money, public money, state money, federal money, experts that I am not know more about this. But you don't have to be a cobbler to know if the shoe fits. And this shoe does not fit. And we need to tell our cobblers we need new shoes. That's all I'm saying. If we can build low-income housing one way or another that's adequate, I'm all for it. But I'm absolutely appalled at the indifference of the government and, unfortunately, of the American people, so that now we have a rising number of homeless and an ever-diminishing number of homes.
Yes, but, you know, if the liberals want all these programs, if they had their way, it would all be centralized into a federal government. And I'm sorry, I kind of distrust that much power in the hands of the federal government.
Well, I
Wouldn't
do, too.
Would you favor a more localized...
I think houses? That... All right, I'll tell you what. I think that now that the right wing has gone national, the progressives have gone local. And you find them in a lot of city councils these days. You find them in state legislatures these days. And I'm in hopes they will come up with new forms of taking care of... human needs that may not centralize all the power in Washington. As I was suggesting earlier, there can be a combination of federal and state money, state and private money that can do a lot of things. So I'm against too much federalization of power, but I am for keeping your eye, a compassionate eye, on the needs of the American people. And not to be put off by saying, well, it's difficult, or there could be some corruption. That does not solve the problem.
Well, okay, back to the corruption thing, though. I was listening to a campaign speech by Mr. Robertson, running for nomination, and he stated an interesting statistic that if you gathered up all the welfare, all the money that for the poor programs, and you were actually able to distribute it among all the poor families, the below poverty would equal out to something like $50,000 per family. And I thought about that, and I said, my goodness, where's all that money going to? It certainly is not ending up in the pockets of the people who deserve it. What's your solution to that?
Well, I'm not sure that I quite followed it. If she said all the money that was being used on the poor?
Yeah, if you state and local subsidies, the housing, the food stamp programs, and all this stuff that was started by Johnson's failed war on poverty, you added them all up, and you'd come up with something like $50,000 per family, per poor family.
And that's what he'd like to do? Give everybody enough for $50,000, Mr. Robertson?
Well, I don't remember exactly what some of the... He didn't get into the specifics of what he wanted to do to clean up the system, but that was one of the...
First of all, I would doubt his use of statistics. If you take something like housing, the vast majority of federal money going into housing, if you count indirect support, which is tax reductions on mortgages, the vast majority of money used in housing goes to support the middle class and the rich, not the poor. Because mortgages, tax reduction on mortgages, is the greatest bite on housing, if I mistake not these days. So his use of the money on housing, I think, needs to be looked at a little more carefully.
I'm have to jump in here.
Right.
I hope the caller will indulge me. My lines are full here, and I want to include some other folks, and I'm heading into my last 15 minutes, so I hope you won't mind if I go on and take somebody else. Just to remind you, if you just tuned in, our guest this morning on the program is the Reverend William Sloan Coffin. He has newly become president of Sane Freeze, which is a national arms limitation group. For the previous 10 years, he was the senior minister of Riverside Church in New York City. He just stepped down at the end of last year to take over Sane Freeze. He's on a national speaking tour, and if you'd like to speak with him, the telephone number here, 333-9455. Toll free in Illinois, it's 800-222-9455. Let me go on to someone on our toll free line here. Hello? Hello? Is there a caller there?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, I just called to give a little statement. The fact is, I can remember like 15, 20 years ago when our local paper here, I live in a city 40 miles southwest of Chicago, our newspaper listed the amounts of money being sent as foreign aid to these various countries around the world. And I talked to different people I knew who were fairly well informed and educated, and they really weren't aware of all this. Well, now, we're living in a highly industrial society here, and it's grown to be sort of an egotistical race and limited about in the number of people that come in each year and so on. And so I feel that we are giving too much call to all these foreign countries. Why do we have to support them, but consider them in everything we do? Why can't they? They have natural resources. We have unlimited. Well, it might be limited resources now, but they have resources. Why can't they do a little of their own supporting in these countries?
Well, as a matter of fact, the primary American foreign aid, I'm sorry to say, is military. And we give it to states that we feel are important in our defense, in the defense of our interests. So Israel receives an enormous amount of aid because we sort of see Israel as the kind of policeman of the Middle East. Egypt gets an enormous amount of money. Turkey gets an enormous amount of money, and enormous amounts of money for aid. If you look at American foreign aid, what it tends to do, this is my criticism of it, is it tends to make the rich richer and the poor poorer and the military more powerful. So what we do with foreign aid troubles me more. But don't think that we're the most generous nation in the world. We're the richest nation in the world, but we're about number 13 or 14 when it comes to proportionate amount of foreign aid. Almost every European nation, I think, I haven't looked at the statistics recently, but almost every industrialized nation of Europe gives proportionately more in foreign aid than we do.
Let me go on here to another caller. Go to line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I had the privilege of attending your meeting last night. I found it very encouraging and informative. There's one item which I think, although you may not have time to discuss it, would be very interesting to the listeners, and that is the amount of money, what could be done with the money that is spent on one Trident submarine.
Mm-hmm.
You said you found the in a magazine on the airplane, and before I finish, could you tell us where we could get a copy of that?
You can get that at the Sane Freeze office, which is in the YMCA.
I see. And could you say something about it in the short time that you have?
I wish I had a copy that I could read it, but I'm afraid.
That's too bad, because I found that to be unbelievably.
Yeah. No, I left it at the newspaper at the last stop. But the idea was that for $1 trillion, you could build $10 million hospitals and you could build $10 million libraries in six central states of the United States. You could have $25,000 for 10,000 teachers, another $25,000 for 10,000. I forget who the other folks were, and you could have cars in the garage in every single family. It was just unbelievable. The basic point being, you have to choose. You want Star Wars or you want Star Schools? And we've been spending so much on the military that we've really been starving our schools, low-income housing to speak of, and so forth. Our priorities have gotten rather badly skewered by our emphasis on national security and military strength, which ironically has changed in the nuclear age so that the more weapons you have, in fact, the less security you have. We are now more insecure than we have been at any time since the end of World War II, and we've spent trillions of dollars on national security.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Let us go on here again to another caller. We have someone here in our line number three. Hello.
Hello. Is that me?
Yes.
Yes. Reverend Coffin, you mentioned earlier this morning you were talking about the needs of the poor, the disenfranchised, and the need for justice, that peace without justice is no peace at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me one change I've noted in the last 20 years or more is when we don't value human life. Being a pastor, you know what the scripture says regarding the sanctity and the value of every human life.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, since Roe versus Wade, 20 million unborn infants have been killed, you might say,
mm-hmm.
destroyed. And I would just, I'll hang up, I'd like to hear your comments, but it seems to me we've seen this happen in other societies. I'm thinking of Germany before the Second World War and during. And I'm thinking in the Soviet Union. And now all over the world we have this being done, which is really a threat to everybody's security.
Mm-hmm.
When one kind of human life is not valued, it seems to me we will not obtain the justice that we need until that wrong is righted.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. I certainly sympathize with what you're saying. I think what we have to bear in mind, however, is that not every person believes that human life begins at the moment a sperm and an egg get together. Jews do not believe that. And to say Jews are unethical for not believing that, I think is wrong. And as a matter of fact, Catholics have not always believed that. In the Middle Ages, there was a theory that until the fetus is ensouled, was the expression, which took place in the estimate of medieval theologians, because there weren't too many doctors who would be able to talk about that then, that took place in about the 12th week. So the first thing we have to say is that everybody's not in agreement that we're talking about full human life at the moment a sperm and an egg get together. And as a matter of fact, even those who are very much against abortion, as I'm sure you are, sir, need to recognize that if a fetus aborts, accidentally, let's say, the Roman Catholic Church doesn't give it a full Christian burial, because there is a sort of common sense recognition that an acorn isn't quite the same thing as a full-grown oak tree, although potentially, there's no question about it, it is. That's the first thing I think we have to say. The second thing is that in countries that have the most liberal abortion legislation, and I think the country now is Japan, it would be hard to say that the Japanese value human life less today than, let's say, Pinochet in Chile, who certainly does not believe in abortion. He's a very strict Orthodox Catholic in that respect. So I think it's a little hard to make the argument that people who do not stand against abortion are less sensitive to human life. I would question that very severely. The last thing I guess I'd want to say is that while I don't think there's any happy position on abortion, I do think that we have to say that a woman living in the slums of Caracas, who can hardly support the 7 children she has already, decides on an abortion. That woman is not morally as culpable as somebody who just doesn't want to take care of children. So I think you cannot exclude motive from this whole matter. And the last thing I'd say is, whereas I think we should be concerned with abortion, we should be primarily concerned with a threatened abortion of the entire human race through nuclear exchange.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left. I have one person on hold. We will talk with them. Hello.
Yeah, David, same question. You mentioned, Reverend, you mentioned a while back about starving education for armament.
Mm-hmm.
And I will agree. I've got 33 years in the military that we squander an awful lot of money on armament.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like your opinion on one thing. At the present rate of funding, a 12-year education in Urbana school systems will cost the average cost will be $36,000. Do you feel that's a starvation level of education?
Well, I don't know about Urbana, but I can tell you that half of the high school kids in New York are dropping out. And that's going to cost society far more in the long run, because these people who haven't a high school education are not going to have access to the new jobs, 7 out of 8 of which demand a high school education.
Well, are they dropping
out? I'm not
out?
Saying that throwing money at it is going to solve the whole thing.
Oh.
But I do think we need to have some money. And always, see, we have to recognize that the more educated people are, the more money they tend to make, and therefore the more taxes they become eligible to pay. So it pays society as a whole to put money into every kid's education, because that kid with more education is going to pay back more in the way of taxes to society. It always saves money to educate society.
Well, I would appreciate it if you'd give us some of the alternatives. You said a moment ago that you can't see that throwing money at the problem is the solution to it. What are some of your alternatives, please, sir? And I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for vocational training, a lot more could be done. I mean, the kids really have to see that if I go into this vocational training, there's a job waiting for me at the other end. I think there's a lot of internships that could be done. Private industry could be very, very helpful at this point. The main problem with so many kids is the problem of motivation. They don't see that they don't seem to be motivated. I'm not an expert on this, and I don't think I want to go on much further, but I do think it has to be a concern that all of us who are parents or even taxpayers have to have. And if we squander our youth, we are wasting our most valuable national asset. That I feel very, very strongly.
Mm. Something else I'd like to ask you about. You know, you have been speaking out on social issues for some time now. And I think mostly with the support of your parishioners, but I know there have been some times that some of them have felt that you were going too far in that, and perhaps, I don't know if they felt that it was just inappropriate for a minister, or you were neglecting your other duties, or you know, whatever. I read that, in fact, last spring there were some people at Riverside that said that they thought you should resign. Yeah. How do you size up those things? That is, you know, your desire, or perhaps you feel duty to be involved socially, mm-hmm, with you know, more conventional, traditional ideas about what clergy is supposed to be about.
Right. Well, that's a very good question. I'd say, to give you some very quick answers, anybody who's a good pastor can get away with almost anything. That you've got to be a good pastor. Where there's grief, you got to be Johnny on the spot. Where there's sickness, you've got to be the first caller. Where there is any kind of trouble, people have to know they can turn to you and they will find a sympathetic ear and a helping hand. Now, people who are good pastors tend to be loved, and then what they have to say from the pulpit will probably be said out of love. I've often said, if you love the good, you have to hate evil. But if you hate evil more than you love the good, you become a damn good hater. Now, what every preacher's got to learn to do is to say what he has to say out of concern for his congregation or her congregation, out of pastoral love for the folk, and not because you want to hit them again harder, you know, or something like that. So if one is pastoral in one's approach, if in the middle of a sermon you say, I know what I want to say now is going to be hard to hear because it's hard for me to say it. But we know that in church, our unity is not based on agreement. It's based on mutual concern. So let me tell you what I think the Bible has to say to us on this point. And then after church, we'll all get together, and you can all tell me where you think I went wrong. Now that, you see, is being very pastoral about dealing with controversial issues. But not to deal with controversial issues, not to deal with war and peace, to say that religion has nothing to say beyond the garden gate, that is unbiblical. And that too many pastors avoid simply because they're afraid of controversy. I see, David, our time is running out. Could I make a slight correction on your view of St. Freese?
Certainly. If I have misstated it, please.
So our listeners have a slightly clearer idea. Saint, as you probably know, was 30 years old this year. It's the oldest peace organization, and we can say the Freeze, which was very effective here in Illinois a few years ago. The Freeze was the sexiest peace movement, you might say. Now the two have decided to get together, and they have merged, feeling that we're modeling the proper behavior in the peace and justice movement. Instead of duplicating, we should cooperate. And we're trying very hard to establish in every congressional district a group of people who are dedicated, who have done their homework, who want to help educate their fellow Americans and keep the fires burning under the asbestos pants, you might say, of some of their congressional representatives, so that Congress people will feel the freedom, shall we say, to vote their better instincts. And that is the hope, and we feel that peace is, as Martin Luther King said, not the absence of conflict, but the presence of justice, as one of the earlier callers said. So it has to be termed a peace and justice movement. We want to see the money saved by arms reduction used for development of our country, development of the third world, and we want to see this interventionary policy, such as Soviet Union has in Afghanistan, and we have by funding the Contras, which is a terrible idea. We want to see that stop. That, in very brief, is the sort of program of Sane Freeze, and anybody who wants to join us is more than welcome.
Yeah, I wish that we had more time. One thing I've been thinking about. I was much struck by a short piece I read that you wrote that appeared in a magazine, U.S. Catholic. I just came across it yesterday, and you were talking about your feelings about dealing with the death of your son, which mm-hmm. happened a couple of years back. And I was much impressed by that final thought, and it strikes me it's worth mentioning, just because so many of the kind of problems that we talk about are big ones, and it's easy to feel overwhelmed by them, and how one, it's a difficult question, how one maintains hope in the face of despair. How do you do that?
Well, for me as a Christian, it isn't that hard. If my beloved Lord and Savior didn't allow his soul to get cornered into despair, who am I? I think any time we're disillusioned, we have to take ourselves to task, because nobody gave us the right to have illusions in the first place. And I think ultimately in this world we have to do what's right, not what's effective. Ultimately, I mean, when they handed Socrates the hemlock, suppose he had said, "Well, wait a minute now, folks, is Plato going to write me up?" Hey, that would have been the end of the game. Or if Nathan Hale said, "Now, wait a minute, before you shoot me, are we going to win this little war? And then is every child in this new nation going to memorize my famous last words?" See, people who have done great things in this world have done them because they were the right thing to do. And ultimately, that's what we all have to do. And then they became very effective later on. I think we have to be faithful. Well, we can't be successful. I think we have to be persistent. Well, we can't be optimistic. I think we have to keep believing despite the evidence, knowing that only in so doing has the evidence any chance of changing. So that being hopeful is refusing to give in to despair. But the opposite of hope is not pessimism. Hope and optimism are not the same. The opposite of hope is despair. And hope recognizes that despair is like all the water in the ocean. It cannot sink a ship until it gets inside. And so our job is to keep that despair outside and to keep cheerfully plodding on. It's going to be a long, stony, and often lonely road to peace and justice, but I can't think of anything more fun, finally, and certainly nothing more worthwhile.
Well, there we'll leave it. I thank you very much for being here.
The preacher's had his word.
The Reverend William Sloan Coffin.